Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mbiwa Gabaza, and for today, we're going to be having a conversation that we've had on a number of occasions on this platform, and that is around the issue of cybersecurity. But for today, we are looking at it from a public sector point of view. That is the word I'm going to use, in other words, government, and you know why this tends to be a very important part of the digital economy that needs to be protected. I think from some of the data that I have researched and read through, governments tend to be some of the most attacked entities in almost any country wherever you go around the world. And when you look at some of the geopolitical issues around the world, Russia, Ukraine, etc., they've also shown us the fact that your state, they call them your state players, can get involved in what some are now calling cyber warfare. So the government cannot extricate itself from doing everything that's possible to protect its digital assets. So to help us to maybe give a little bit of context into what's going on locally for the South African government, and then maybe even giving us a bigger picture context, today I am at Accenture's offices. I'm joined by Gugu Nyanda, and she is a public sector lead for Africa for Accenture, and we're just going to be having that discussion around government and cybersecurity. Google, greetings to you today.
Greetings, Mudiwa, and greetings to your listeners.
So, I've said a lot of things, just now. And when I was doing some research, there's something that you had written, and you highlighted a couple of big cases where the South African government has recently been, publicly, attacked. The first one, I think, being the attack on the South African Health Laboratory that blocked patients' lab results and compromised highly sensitive patient and, government employee data. And then the second one was the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. And that one, it was revealed that over 300 million Rand had actually been stolen over 10 years from that situation. It sounds like it's a really bad time. I think where I want to start today's conversation is to say, from your experience, is there political will to deal with cybersecurity issues in South Africa?
Certainly, Mudiwa, I think the political will is there. I think sometimes what might be missing is the depth of awareness of just the implications of having weak cybersecurity systems for the state, right? And so if you have noticed, the stance of government is always to keep citizens calm, right? So there will be a cyber attack that happens in the National Health Laboratory, a cyber attack that happens at Transnet that brings the operations of Transnet, Ports Authority and TPT to a halt. Government's stance is to almost try and manage there is no crisis, right? And that is okay, because it is the responsibility of government to keep the citizens calm and maintain law and order. However, that unfortunately also underscores just how perhaps the state is not really fully appreciative of the implications of a cyber attack and what it can do, right? And so even though the will is there, just perhaps the starting point for me could be, who is responsible for keeping the digital assets of the state safe across government?
That's a good question.
We have lots of agencies that are responsible in parts for something. We have a regulator. There is a regulating the protection of personal information, for example, which is excellent. We have the state security agency that is responsible for intelligence. We have CETA responsible for something else. But you rarely are able to find a coherent or perhaps a locus that says this is the state entity that is responsible for keeping these digital assets safe. So that's the first problem, not necessarily the lack of political will.
You know, it's actually interesting that you say that, because I think in the last maybe, let's call it 2 to 3 years, we've seen the information regulator making a lot of noise around what's going on in the private sector, you know, taking on the likes of Facebook and WhatsApp and, you know, all of these things. But as you were speaking just now, I realized, wow, is there a centralized way in which government security matters are dealt with? And then as you were talking about CETA and then, you know, national intelligence and then all this, I was now saying, okay, does every government department at least have a CISO inside them? At least, yeah.
So they, normally a CISO responsibility will be allocated to the CIO of that entity, okay, particularly if it's department level. I think for state-owned entities, there is a certain level of maturity that has progressed, and so a role of a CISO is appreciated at the same time. So, but my take on it, and obviously we are always open to debate on these matters, but my personal take is that what is needed is almost a single locus that is just going to focus on the security. We have been very good as the South African government, and I say we because, I mean, we are citizens of this country, in protecting personal information and then criminalizing all sorts of things that could happen to violate personal information. And that is excellent. However, cybersecurity is a lot of things other than just looking out for personal information. It's looking out for just making sure that everyone who is an employee in the state, for example, has a certain level of understanding and awareness of how they themselves, as individuals who work for the state, can help in keeping the cybersecurity space safe for government, right? So it's those kinds of things that are almost holes that we need to start saying when you're seeking solutions. How do we help the state rethink how it's dealing with cybersecurity?
Yeah. One of the things I was now thinking about is when you look at the structure of the South African government, how do you think that centralized function should actually flow? If you look at, you know, the likes of, I think, your Chinas, your Russias, you know, other countries, at least from the outside, it looks as if that government cybersecurity has almost taken on a military type of flavor, you know, to it, right? But I guess South Africa exists in a slightly different context. So how do you think, you know, those types of dynamics can work here?
I think you are on the money, because those countries that deal with it from that perspective of being a military issue, it's because they understand that the stakes are high.
Yes.
You know, the stakes are seriously high. So they would assign the cybersecurity responsibility mandate and the safety thereof to a defense, for example, defense department, or to somebody else who's dealing with intelligence. However, that in itself, though, has its own pitfalls. So you want to make sure that the governance structures and the mechanism of securing, you know, where someone who is, let's say, a police officer is being policed by someone. So those governance structures become important, because if for example, we militarize it, or we put it in intelligence, this responsibility, there are all sorts of technological assets and arsenal that they have, that they can look after the security of the citizens. Unfortunately, they can also be misused in the wrong hands, right? So you do not want, for example, an intelligence service that has access to your conversations on the phone, tapping into you without guardrails. So the guardrails have got to be there. So assign responsibility, and there's clear locus of control where that responsibility should lie, whether it's militarized or it's elsewhere, doesn't really matter. But then have a set of governance rules and regulations that are going to make sure that the police is being policed by someone else so that they don't abuse their authority. Yeah. You know, so that kind of structure is what enables other countries to make sure that their spaces are safe. Now, I use the example of employees. You know, government is a really large employer. They employ in excess of 1 million people in different entities. And I say, imagine each person, because they have access to a laptop that is assigned or a gadget that is assigned to them by the employer, being a potential entry point into your network and servers. And, you know, and so each person must be aware of this huge responsibility that they have, because a phishing scam or a scammer can attack through these people that are all logging into the network, yeah. Right? So that is why it's important for any employer, and I use us as Accenture as an example. It's important for any employer to make sure that the employees are aware of the role they need to play themselves. So one level, which we have spoken about, Mudiwa, is at institutional level and making sure that the mandates are clear, but then there's an individual level so that this institutional mandate is also assisted and secured by the employees. Now, if as an employee, you log into an open network, you are sitting at the airport trying to check your email, you are logging into your emails, but you are using a free Wi-Fi service that has absolutely no security, you become almost immediately
a sitting duck. Yeah.
As does the rest of the people that you are connected with in that network. Yeah. You know?
So yeah, it does become, you know, quite a proper weak link and a weak chain. And I guess that's where one of the biggest problems with cybersecurity comes in. We often talk to experts, and you know, the one thing that always comes up is to say that no matter how advanced the technology is, it's human error that is often you know, the biggest point of vulnerability. Yes. When it comes to an organization. Now, I wanted to maybe not switch gears, but you know, change it a bit to as far as you can see, right? In management theory, they say that when it comes to change or implementing any type of change, you often have the people at the bottom, right, who are at the coal face and understand that the change needs to happen. And then you've got people at the top who, because strategy is their bread and butter, they also need to understand, they also know that a change needs to happen and what needs to happen. But it's the people in the middle, you know, that are often the most resistant to, you know, your change and implementing that and, you know, having progress. Now, the problem with government and the public sector is that it's not homogenous, right?
Yes.
You've got departments, you've got SOEs, you've got municipalities, you've got all these different, you know, manner of government departments. From your experience, right? Who is at the most risk? We understand government as a whole is at risk, but as far as you can see, who in the chain is the most, in terms of either departments or SOEs, yeah, how do you see that playing out?
So I think the biggest risk are departments that almost do transactions with the public, electronic transactions for one reason or another. So using example of Home Affairs, yeah. Right? There are lots of transactions that Home Affairs conducts digitally. In a way that is supposed to be improving the citizens' lives, and they do improve citizens' lives in that way. But the more you have people transacting through a network that in itself is found vulnerable,
yeah.
The more risky you are, the more at risk you are to be a point of entry. Let me not say vulnerable, but more a point of entry, because all that is required is one level of weakness that is transacting into this system. Someone who is using the new system for applying for an ID, for example, or a visa application, or you're applying for a passport. the more you have these transactions as a department, the more at risk you would be if your employees that are processing these things are, you know, sharing passwords, for example, or someone needs to do some work and they were out in a cafe and therefore they just use an open network. So that's where the biggest vulnerability might be, the transactions that happen digitally. But the good thing, there's always a good thing with the state, is they are good mechanism of organizing itself. So there is, for example, a CIO council that is headed by the CIO of DPSA. And so they meet regularly. And amongst other things they discuss is how do they keep government secure, right? So if we were to talk about management theory and how then we use change management to effect the change that we think is supposed to happen within the state, those kinds of organized bodies become your best entry point, right? So I would be talking, for example, to the JITO Council, which is that council that sits the CIOs, to get them to have a coordinated approach on how they then influence the rest of their departments and run through whatever change management program that is necessary to get the change to permeate. But training is also just one other way of doing this. So if we had to say we are now able to identify areas of risks, how do we then mitigate this risk? So you can run training programs. Not all of them require classroom sitting. Some of them are online, you know, just to get people to appreciate the you know, what we call basic hygiene.
Yeah.
You know, you don't share passwords. For example, if you are standing up and leaving your laptop, you don't leave it open so that anyone can come in and use it. You don't use free open Wi-Fi networks because they are going to be vulnerable. And, you know, those kinds of basic hygiene things, you can run them through training and you can work with a coordinated structure so that you can, they permeate through this middle layer that you're saying is quite difficult to crack.
Mm. It's actually very interesting, you know, to hear that there are so many, I guess, coordinated efforts to help solve something like that. But I guess that's the biggest problem that a government faces when you're dealing with such a big body, like you said, over a million employees, and it's across, you know, the country, it's across provinces, it's across functions. It's a crazy amount of complexity to be dealing with. One of the things that I'm now curious about is from an Accenture point of view, right? Who is, this is a chicken versus an egg question, right? Are you guys going to government and saying, have you thought about A, B, C, and D? Or is government coming to an Accenture and saying, hey, can you help us to refine our thinking on whatever this problem is?
It's a very interesting relationship that Accenture will have with government, because as a service provider and government being hamstrung by the PFMA in terms of how they engage service providers, we struggle to reach out and put what we call a point of view on the table. But we do occasionally host sessions where we'll then invite government participants to say, these are the trends, you know, because what you want is for people who work for the state to be always, I don't know, 5-10 steps ahead of where the trends are going, because the cyber criminal is also there, right? So what we try and do is we do thought leadership, we prepare publications, we post them on social media and say, this is where the trends are going. That is almost as best as we can do without appearing like you are influencing their thinking. And at the same time, also, government is also good in hosting their own sessions where they invite experts and subject matter experts to then address them on these issues. So I think there is almost, it's both what you are saying. It's us who put point of views on the table using different media outlets, and occasional government reaching out when they have open sessions where neither one of us is going to be seen to be trying to influence the other and trying to get a tender, you know? Yeah, but so that's how we normally try and manage it.
Okay. And from what you can, whatever you can share with us, when those engagements are being done, what are the actual, we've spoken, you know, quite in esoteric terms about what's going on in cybersecurity and all of this stuff, but on the ground, what are the things that government is actually concerned about when it comes to cybersecurity?
So the biggest concern, unfortunately, becomes only just one part. And that's the unfortunate bit. As I'm saying, the concern is, how do we protect personal information? How do we protect individuals from being harmed by cyber criminals? And I think that is a noble goal, right? My thesis is, it is only just one aspect. And government is really good at that, right? So the regulator, for example, Advocate Ntlakula is the regulator, will really take organizations to task if there's information leaks and, you know, hold them to account. And that's what concerns government. But I do think government should also be concerned about the other bits that is probably going to resolve 80% of the problem.
Okay.
You know,
we use 80-20.
Yeah. You know? and so that is about this individual that is working for you at the one level being the entry point for a vulnerability. But second, the government tends to work a lot on old technologies for one reason or another.
Yes, lots of legacy systems.
Sometimes, even if it's something like Microsoft, where the state spends quite a significant amount of money annually on just the licenses of Microsoft. And Microsoft has advanced, you know, they have the latest technologies that can help government manage these cybersecurity attacks, for example. But you find that the state is only using 10% of the functionality that they are buying in the license, because they are operating on Windows XP, you know, which is really ancient.
Yeah.
And, or they are operating on MS Office, I don't know, 2011. They have not updated this system, both the operating system and whatever other software programs that they're using. And so they can't benefit from the R&D that goes into the new technologies that almost by design is foolproof when it comes to cyber attacks, right? So if we could get to a point where the state appreciates the importance of updates, software and technology updates.
Basic updates.
Just basic updates.
Right?
So we start with getting our employees ready and appreciating of this need for cybersecurity. We then make sure that the systems that we're using are updated. Then it resolves literally 80% of the problem. I kid you not.
That's an interesting way of I guess, contextualizing the problem. And like you said, it sounds like such a simple thing, you know, update your systems, right? But I guess coordinating and actually implementing those things is, you know, a very tough situation. And also, I guess, making people following up to actually check that people are doing so is, it's probably a big mess.
Again,
on its own.
Sorry, Mudio. Then again, we use our example as Accenture. So Accenture employs in excess of 750,000 people globally. So as an employer, we are very close in terms of numbers to the South African government. And so we have tried and tested methods that are all almost facing similar challenges in terms of lack of willingness of people to change and inability, for example, of organizations to translate strategy into the operations to the lowest level, you know. So all of those challenges we would also be facing. We've done it before. Now, how do we then do it to actually get it to happen? So again, taking the employee. So for us as Accenture, we have something that we call a technology quotient. Each employee has a number. That technology quotient, in the same way that your IQ and your emotional intelligence has an EQ number, TQ represents my literacy level when it comes to technologies.
That's cool.
And you use this TQ to have training programs that are then going to say at a certain point, Mudiwa has actually so advanced on his technology education program that he's now, I don't know, a 14 out of 14. And in as part of that, there is a security element. So when these new technologies that are emerging, now, for example, in the last few years, AI really became top of mind. We have AI programs now that everyone in our teams has to take an hour of their time occasionally and run through the program and then do a test. And this is such that you can't wish it away, right? So it's forced that you are going to do it. You are going to be given time. If you want 2 months, it's fine. You can take 2 months to do it. But by end of August, if you have not done it, I'm going to have a say on whether you get your bonus or not. Yeah. So this is a way of doing two things. One, making sure that people are abreast with the technology as they develop, but to help them help themselves by making this compulsory so that they can't opt out of it.
Okay. It's actually a very interesting, you know, way of doing things. And I know that a lot of organizations do try, you know, where they can to do something like that. I know that with our own organization, you know, there are periodic times where you can have a Microsoft training or something on something that's new. And we also have our own back-end systems that we use for our various publications, Business Day or whatever it is. And for you to be able to do your job effectively on a daily basis, you need to know how the system works. So periodically, if there's changes in the, what you call this, if there's any changes in the system, you either get literature on it or there's like an actual training workshop that's actually given out there to make things, to make things happen.
Mm. You see, those are good lessons that the state could learn from, because then people can't opt out of it.
No, yeah. No. It becomes almost a core part of, you know, what you're doing. Now, where I want to end today's conversation, Google, is to the stakes, right? Mm. How do we translate the stakes to become more tangible to people, right? I understand we've used the example of Russia a couple of times, right? But they are in a war right now. And the cyber element has become a big piece of how that war has been characterized. So the stakes are obvious, right? You've got, you've got state actors that could potentially switch off electricity or a grid in an enemy territory, just using online systems. So the stakes are very high, yes, and it's well understood in that situation. But in South Africa, how do you translate, right? Because everything we're talking about, right, is, I think the best way I can explain it for me is I'm an economist. Mm-hmm. So in economics, we say that people work in the self-interest. And when people are working in the self-interest, the first thing you always think about is what's in it for someone, right? And what is the incentive, right? So if your incentive is we might have an entire electricity or water grid fall down, shut down, right? Then you're going to take that thing very seriously. But in a case like this where the examples and the case studies are already obvious, and we've already mentioned a couple of them earlier on. You've spoken about Transnet, we spoke about the laboratories, right? There's so many of these examples, and they're not stopping. By the time we get to December, it's likely that we would have heard about one or two other big ones. And then there's all the ones that, you know, through my experience, both public and private sector players don't want to disclose that they've been attacked. So chances are there's thousands that we just never, ever, ever hear about. So against all that, that huge body of evidence, how is it that people still don't get the urgency of the situation?
Yeah, yeah. It's the stakes. So people tend to relate better if you quantify the stakes. And we can do this at different levels. So at a personal level for employees, for example, you would have seen some people crying foul about how their account was hacked and they lost money in their bank account because someone cloned their WhatsApp. And this person could only have cloned their WhatsApp, for example, because they logged onto an open network, right? Because they wanted to access data and connectivity. That becomes an entry point through your WhatsApp into your bank account. At individual level, you literally lose money and people have lost it. They just don't make the connection of what happened, right? But at a macro level, if you imagine someone is playing around with a figure that I'm not sure how true it is, but that Transnet has the capacity to bring in R1 billion every day in terms of revenue, right? Now, if you imagine that for the economy, if you imagine that for 3 days, they had to shut down operations because of a cyber attack. And we play around with Transnet numbers of 3 days, R1 billion, because as you say, no one is actually taking responsibility to tell us as the nation, take us into their confidence and say, actually, we were attacked. And yes, we had to shut down operations for this number of days. So it almost sounds like speculation, but let's say for the sake of argument, those numbers are true, that the economy cannot then generate almost R1 billion that they could have generated because the operations had to shut down because of a cyber attack. That's how bad things could be, right? But there are also, there's human life at stake as well. So it's not just the numbers. So if again, we go back to the laboratory services as an example. So a doctor is now has put this patient on an operating table. They need to operate because of some emergency. But in order to do that, they need data on this person's history so that they know how much anesthetic can they give me, you know, how much drug of X can they put into my body because of my history. They cannot determine that because someone has attacked the laboratory services and is not releasing that kind of data. So the stakes tend to be very high. And to a certain degree, our struggle to be able to quantify what that stake looks like is precisely because of the initial reaction that everyone assumes, as you were saying, their position, whether private or public, is to deny, 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 we were not attacked. Or if we were attacked, reduce the impact that it has actually had. But the stakes are really high.
Yeah. All right. So that's where we end off. It has been a really great discussion just talking about what's going on in terms of public sector, private cybersecurity. Very interesting, you know, just to hear some of the factors that are going on in terms of taking this issue seriously. Right at the top of the conversation, Google said that there is political will, you know, around these issues, but it's understanding the stakes, that is where some of the biggest disconnects, you know, are happening. And, you know, she was also just giving us some insight into, you know, some of the factors that actually go on, in terms of making all of this a reality. One of the big things that she started off talking about is the fact that, when it comes to implementation of, you know, either the cybersecurity rules or who polices it, we need to at least agree on who the central body is. And she does advocate for a central body of some sort, to make that happen. We also spoke about the fact that in other countries, it's become a military, type of function, which is working for some countries. But she does say that, you know, as good as that is, it does come with certain drawbacks because you need to have someone who polices the people that are policing, especially around the issue of governance, and also just getting into, you know, some of the factors of the different types of government departments. We also went a little bit, you know, into the world of 80-20. And one of the things she said that could probably just help, you know, up to 80% of the issues is just having updated systems, you know, that are being used by government across the board, and then obviously ending off talking about the difficulty when it comes to, you know, quantifying some of the risks that are out there. So that was us. It was a really great discussion. Thank you so much. We were in conversation with Bunyanda, who is from Accenture Google. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Modiwe. It was an interesting discussion. Thank you.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.